from here, what would you like to see happen now?
Well, what I'd like to see is proportional representation adopted. You know, they created this process, so they should, you know, if they're going to have this process, they should respect kind of the feedback they got. They chose it. But other things they could do, there's, you know, another new citizens assembly, I think would be productive. The BC Liberals have actually promised that in the previous referendum and then reneged on the promise immediately once the results were known. And the other is the conservative vice chair of the committee talked about having municipal electoral reform, you know, try some of these systems out potentially at a municipal level first and give at least municipalities the option to take these systems. I think that would be very productive too.
You're an SFU student and you've been involved with Fair Vote, I think you said, for more than 10 years. Mm-hmm. Why is this so important to you?
You know, I that's a hard question. I think I was radicalized as a student in my first undergraduate degree that I thought in our student elections that I had a student union at one level that used proportional representation. Yeah. And then I had at another level that used first past the post, and you got much more adversarial politics in first past the post than you did in the proportional system and less reflective of the student. So, you know, student elections have pretty low turnout. I don't know how reflective you're going to get in general. And it just, the more I dug into it, the more it made sense to me. Like, I think the arguments for proportional representation are really the same as the arguments for democracy itself, that the voters aren't going to be right 100% of the time, but they're more likely to be right than having, you know, like some kind of distortion of that. And you see in like BC, you know, the 1996 election where the BC Liberals got more votes than the NDP, but the NDP formed a majority government thanks to just the vagaries of where the election boundaries are. I was pretty young for that one, but I remember it distinctly, and that bothered me. And then the next election, NDP got almost wiped out, and the Liberals got almost every seat. It really was formative that this is not working really for anyone. Right. And I'd add to that, too. Like, I think one thing is I feel, just as a voter and an activist, I make too many compromises when I go to the ballot box, and I would like to be better able to express what I want in a more honest and nuanced way.
Right. Thanks so much for speaking to me today. Ryan Campbell is a representative for Fair Vote Canada and an SFU student. Thanks so much for talking to me today, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
Very interesting discussion there. As mentioned in the interview, the option towards changing our voting system has come up quite often in recent, three times in the last 20 years, and the discussion never seems to entirely go away.
No, not really.
Thanks, Peter.
But I'm going to say one thing that they should keep in the North American continent, only the city of Vancouver and the city of Victoria have it that you don't vote just for your area for the council person.
Yeah, well, when I was did the interview with Ryan there afterwards, we did talk about that because we had a really good conversation about, you know, municipal voting and, you know, whether we wanted to should go to a ward system or some other difference. Because, you know, with municipal elections, we sort of, there's a big list of candidates and then you vote for as many candidates as you're allowed to, and then whoever gets the most votes. So it's still kind of a first past the post system. And I am going to, you know, we have municipal elections coming up in about a year. Yeah. And I am going to talk to Ryan again about that closer date. But one of the things he pointed out was that really tends, it's typical in most communities that better off areas have higher voter turnout than poorer areas in communities. It's just
seems if they to be have with. The ward system.
Yeah. And so those, basically speaking, people who are better off get much better represented in civic government than other folks for that, because of that sort of built-in, built-in tendency. I'm not going to call it a bias, but
so he wants the ward system.
Well, he was actually had a much more nuanced answer about it, and it was a few weeks ago, so I can't really remember exactly what he said, so I don't want to sort of try and represent his thoughts on it. But we will be talking about that again closer to next year's municipal elections.
I'm against the ward system. Anyway, I'll just that's it. I think it's because then you have the opportunity to go to any councillor you want. You just don't go to your own.
Yeah.
You can choose. And I think it's a more dynamic thing about how the public can deal with the council.
Yeah.
So that's just, I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, well, like I say, I don't want to get into the details, but he wasn't necessarily in favor of the ward system. There are some other options for reforming municipal elections in a way that would provide better representation.
Anyway, you want to talk about
about
the bad deal that they want to give the Ukrainian.
Yes, this week again there is a push, particularly from the United States, to try and create a peace agreement around the Russia-Ukraine war. A meeting was supposed to be happening with almost all the players, the Europeans and the Ukrainians and the Russians, but it seems that the United States sort of got in there on its own and actually had talks between itself and Russia about a peace agreement for Ukraine without including the Ukrainians, which seems pretty... it's perhaps par for the course, because much of the ceasefire in Gaza was arranged the same way, with the United States figuring things out with Israel and then telling the Hamas, you know, what that would be. But it does seem, as you say, it doesn't seem to be a very good deal for Ukraine. There's 28 points in all, but perhaps the key takeaways are that it would allow Russia to keep most of the territory it is currently occupied, and would normalize that arrangement by having countries recognize that change in ownership, while at the same time restricting the Ukrainians in their defense arrangements.
Also, they're not going to be allowed to join NATO.
And a third, yeah.
And they will not allow to be Russia to be persecuted for any war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just a totally non-deal. It's sort of just, and it's just turned down.
Yeah.
But remember years ago, and it seemed like this was a bit... I kind of didn't think that the Russian collusion they were talking about in the first term, at the time it seemed like it wasn't happened. Now with all this, you wonder if it actually did, because the whole attitude is seemed to go that there was Russian collusion at some point. Mm-hmm. Because... it's almost like the axis of evil now is Russia, United States, and mainland China. And that they're
good. Funny how they're three of the biggest powers in the world, and somehow they, you know.
I mean, for example, if the United States wasn't going to put all these tariffs on Canada, both Canada and the United States could have been dealing with mainland China. And a lot better. We're forced that we're just, or Mark Carney, who's going to be talking for us, that we're just forced into just trading with them, mm-hmm. without much complaint or much nuance to it. So he's sort of operating. Donald Trump's just operating on, and it, you know, like they got this new New York mayor. He hasn't become mayor yet,
yeah.
But he elect. And it's funny that. How Trump sort of operates. It's like, oh, I like the guy. He's totally, I mean, I think he's just saying that. This is how his mode of operandi. It's like, oh, I like him because he knows he's in. So it's like, I, he's just pretending to like him or something kind of strange.
Well, it does, you know, going back to Ukraine, it does seem like a common thread of the Trump administration's approach to trying to solve this war is to talk to the Russians, find out what they want, and then, because this has happened several times where, you know, they come up with a proposal that mostly seems to be a Russian wish list for what they want, and doesn't seem to really take into account or even respect, you know, the wishes or the needs of the Ukrainians. And of course, inevitably, it fails. You know, just the very fact that, you know, the idea that the Ukraine should just trust Russia, cut its military back severely, not get any international guarantees, and feel that that's going to work out well for them, I can't see how they'd ever expect that. They already had an international guarantee from 1994 when they agreed to give up their nuclear weapons, because there were a substantial chunk of the Soviet nuclear arsenal was based in the Ukraine and passed to Ukraine when Ukraine became an independent nation, and they agreed to give that up, pass those weapons back to Russia in return for security guarantees of their land and sovereignty, which Russia has not respected at all. Why would they respect this deal that we're talking about here, particularly when this deal seems to try to create a weakened Ukraine?
Oh, yeah. As I say, there seems to be some collusion with Russia in some way, or he seems to be aligned. The other thing is that it's interesting that is it the president of the Ukraine? Oh, good. He has been insulted continually, whereas Putin really is sort of complimented. Yeah, which is pretty bad.
One other thing I think about this whole situation is it just emphasizes the need for the Europeans to strengthen their ability to operate independently of the United States on issues like this. Of course, you know, ever since the Second World War within NATO, you know, the United States has acted as the de facto leader and as the biggest member, kind of always was able to get its way. But as long as I think goals and values were kind of aligned, as they were through much of the Cold War era, and even over most of the last 30 years, that was okay. And I think in many ways Europeans got used to that, and it allowed them to not build up what's necessary to be really independent. But now there's this, every time this issue comes up of the peace agreements, of intended peace agreements, it always seems to be something that really favors Russia, disfavors the Ukraine, and then leaves Europe sort of vulnerable to what might be seen as further Russian aggression.
Well, I don't know how credible this concept is, but a NATO without the United States, in the sense that and have the Ukraine made part of NATO, and just not have the United States part of NATO, because I just throw that out as a concept about whether that's a valid one or not, because it's that would be perhaps a better situation in some ways.
Yeah. Well, like I say, I mean, I think there's, you know, I don't think we want to have NATO entirely, or, you know, break up NATO in that way. I think that obviously there's, I think we'd want to keep.
Well, why would you want the United States in NATO?
Well, I don't think the Trump administration is, well, hopefully the Trump administration isn't going to always be there. But I think keeping that alliance together is important.
What do you mean it's the United States in NATO? That's what you're basically talking about. What, right. Because of money, monetary support?
I think just keeping a Western bloc together. All right, we have some other guests going to jump in just a couple moments. We're going to give you something from Climate Connections here, and we'll be back in about a minute and a half to talk about, listen up, indie concert coming up this weekend here at SFU.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Some island-dwelling animals only live in one place, so if a major hurricane hits that island, it could be catastrophic for the species. For example, a small bird called the Bahama nuthatch once lived on the island of Grand Bahama. The bird's population had declined for years, mainly because of habitat loss and non-native predators. But last decade, hurricanes Matthew and Dorian each slammed into Grand Bahama and likely wiped out the species entirely. David Pereira, a researcher at the University of Birmingham, documented the nuthatch's decline during a field study in 2018.
It makes me feel really sad, obviously, because I saw one of the last nuthatches.
Climate change is now making hurricanes stronger, which increases the risk to isolated island species. So Pereira worked with other researchers to create a watch list of the species most threatened by hurricanes. He says it can be used to prioritize conservation efforts, like setting up breeding programs for these species before catastrophe strikes.
We are running against time because we can already see from the nuthatch case that one bird potentially has gone extinct because of a hurricane, and we don't want this to happen to other species.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
And we're back. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Joining me in the studio here are some folks from an exciting concert happening this weekend called Listen Up. And maybe you guys can introduce yourselves.
Hello.
Yeah.
My name is Nathan. I'm the treasurer of the Geography Student Union, and we're putting on this show this weekend.
My name is Ali, and I'm the events coordinator of the Geography Student Union, and I'm also an organizer of the show.
Great.
My name is Hugh. I'll be doing sound for the event.
Awesome. So what inspired you guys to put on this show?
So mostly because myself and Nathan have been going to a lot of local shows, and then when we found out that there's a scene in all their universities in BC, so UBC and UVic, we were inspired to do something like this at SFU, and we were also puzzled by the lack of similar shows.
Why don't we jump into telling me who's going to perform at the event, because that's what's going to drag people out. So tell us about some of the artists.
So Steve Gonzalez, I think they're great friends of GSF. The Lunchtime Band and Tiger Lily will be playing at the show.
Excellent. And it's coming up this Saturday. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so it's going to be on Saturday at the SFU Sub Ballroom, so right above the studio here. Tickets are going to be $15, either in advance or at the doors. And it's going to be opening up at 5 and then starting at 5:30. So then it should end at around 8:30 or whenever.
I think this is a great initiative because, like you, we here at the radio station, we've sort of been surprised at how there aren't that many events of this sort happening. And one of the things it takes is, you know, it takes some momentum. It takes people like you creating events like this and putting them on. And that creates some momentum towards the next event. So I think it's awesome that you guys are doing this. We've been trying to put on some events in the building as well. Are you thinking of doing other events down the road? Or?
Yeah, definitely. I think if this everything goes well for this one, we would ideally want to do something in the spring, maybe in the summer, if we have the capacity for it. Definitely if the OSSS allows us to do more of these events, for sure.
You guys had to struggle a bit to get the room booked.
Speed bumps, but, you know, we're here, and it's definitely going to happen. So we're really glad about that.
All right, tell me again, who's playing, and when should people show up?
So Sleepy Gonzalez, the Lunchtime Band, and Tiger Lily are playing. Doors will be at 5 p.m., and they will start playing at 5:30.
Excellent. And those are all local Vancouver bands, so come on out this Saturday, support local music, and support fun musical events here at SFU. We need more of them.
We do.
Yeah, we do. We deeply do.
Well, thanks so much, you guys, for dropping in, but also, I think even more importantly, for taking initiative to put on and create an event like this. I think it's really great, and I hope others here on campus and are inspired by your efforts.
I hope so, too.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. So turn out, that's what I was trying to say. turn out this weekend for Listen Up, live local music right here in the sub at SFU. How much is the cost?
$15.
See, a bargain for three great bands coming out Saturday at 5 p.m. Thanks for coming out, guys.
Thank you.
All right. Here's another local band you can listen to. And this is Stephen Ham and Stephen Ham, the Theremin Man. Stephen Ham, the Theremin Man. Stephen Ham is a long-time fixture on the local music scene, going all the way back to the 80s and has played in too many Vancouver bands to mention. Of course, this is one of his solo projects with the Theremin, as you can hear in the background there.
So I just recently, I suppose you knew about this for quite a while, that Taiwan makes quite a few semiconductors. Worldwide, it's 60% of the semiconductors come from Taiwan, 90% of the advanced chips. But to put under, for the United States, 44.2% of the logic chips come from Taiwan, and 24.4% of the memory chips come from Taiwan.
It's kind of amazing when you think about how important semiconductors and chips like that are to just about everything we do. I mean, almost everything we do these days is powered by some kind of computer, large or small. And that so much of that is concentrated in one single country.
Yes. I mean, so it makes the tension between Taiwan and mainland China into similar dimensionality. You know, here's some things about mainland China. It creates 16% of its own semiconductors, and 60% of what they import comes from Taiwan. So there's a basic arithmetic how much that would be. But anyway, so they're sort of dependent on Taiwan in a way, because if they do attack Taiwan, there's sort of one video I said, was it, that maybe Taiwan would destroy its own companies. as opposed to having the have mainland China taking them over, or whatever. I mean, it's sort of, I mean, it would sort of cause a bit of an imbalance around the world about where the certain semiconductors are coming from, including for mainland China itself, because it could well be that they would choose to destroy their factories as opposed to having mainland China take it over. So maybe that's one reason why it's not going to happen, perhaps. The other thing is that the United States put it not for the semiconductors, but for other goods. They said we're going to put a 20% tariff on Taiwan goods that weren't superconductors, however, semiconductors. Mm-hmm. But there was this threat of a 300% tariff on semiconductor exports from Taiwan, which people in Taiwan think it's not going to basically happen. Basically. But one of the things that was sort of interesting to me was, how did this sort of evolve? There's a company which does the majority of it, the TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturer Corporation, and they were established in 1987. But I guess they just sort of, one thing that the company did, they sort of did the opposite of what Microsoft did. Microsoft wanted it that it was just compatible with its own technology. What this corporation said, well, it's important for us to be adaptable, period. Mm-hmm. We're not going to be against the people that are our customers. So they basically just made themselves adaptable. And they kind of just pinpointed this one thing over right. the years. And the other thing, when I was looking at a few YouTube postings about this, there's one machine that says it costs $200 million, which is part of the process of making them. And it's sort of like, if you're sort of wanting to do it yourself, they already have one in Washington State from this corporation.
Yeah.
And they're going to have one over in Arizona, supposedly, yeah. to be dealing with it. But it's interesting that they just sort of pinpointed this one thing in 1987 as such. I guess it's become more and more important as things have gone forth.
One thing I've read about it is one of the reasons that for the concentration is that the whole process is so complicated and requires such sort of precision. And as you mentioned, you know, the machinery or the tooling required to do it, $200 million for this thing. And, you know, that's not, you know, that's just for a machine to help them make it. That it's just so incredibly complicated, the process, and they developed all that expertise that kind of given them a huge lead now in terms of staying out front of everyone else, between the sort of complexity of the process, the expertise they've developed there, and the cost of developing that elsewhere.
The thing is, if mainland China were to invade Taiwan and keep it intact, how would that company be operating? Like, one thing that was interesting, the one in Washington State, a lot of the Americans feel they're making them work harder than they would usually do.
I don't know. I mean, one thing I've heard is they would try and remove the plants, etc., back to somewhere else so that they don't fall into Chinese hands. But it's hard to say, you know. I mean, what I suppose, you know, on a great power competitive issue, they don't want all that technology to fall into Chinese hands, because Chinese is an adversarial power.
So maybe that's causing an equilibrium
All right.
In the situation.
Cool. Well, thanks for that, Peter. We have Democracy Now! Coming up in about 20 minutes. We're going to play you out with just a little bit of Sleepy Gonzales. They're playing this weekend. this weekend in the sub as part of the Listen Up music concert. And we're excited to see fun stuff like that happening here on the SFU campus.